on the agenda, they were just here, working on the, PPT, sorry. And the first bill we have up is SJR number 19 by Senator Gary Stevens. Are you going to do the presenting, Senator Stevens?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This resolution would create a task force that will assess the, I'm Senator Gary Stevens from Kodiak.
Thank you.
At first, I should tell you, Madam Chair, that we, at first looking at a bill that would create a reporting system and realized that we were a little premature. So this resolution takes the place of that and creates a task force to assess public reporting of healthcare associated with infections. And there are 10 members. I won't go through those unless you necessarily want to hear them. But primarily, I think, Madam Chair, we found that this is a major problem throughout the country. There are 2 million infections a year that are acquired in hospitals, and the estimation is that some 90,000 people die in the country. So it, because of that, it becomes the sixth leading cause of death in the United States. And of course, the cost of these deaths, these acquired infections, is between $4.5 to $11 billion a year, so pretty alarming statistics. So it's really, I think, extremely important that consumers have full knowledge of how medical facilities fare with terms of infections rates, and just, I won't take much of your time, Madam Chair, but just to mention a couple of issues we've discovered is that sometimes the solution is very simple. A report in ABC News, Betsy McCowey, the former Lieutenant Governor of New York, said that these infections kill as many people each year in our country as AIDS, breast cancer, and auto accidents combined. So it really is a really enormous problem. And it's a problem that truly needs to be addressed. The plan of this this resolution would be to have an interim task force appointed to review public reporting in Alaska of hospital-associated infections, to develop a white paper for drafting legislation next year and reporting those infections, to identifying the data sources, the outcome, prepare a timeline for implementation, and to talk about a reporting system. So, Madam Chairwoman, that's it in a nutshell. We'd be glad to answer any questions, and there are others here. Rod Beattie from the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association, and Dr. Magister is here as well.
Are there questions for the sponsor? I'm going to be certain that the January 1 date and the January 31 and the termination date are you're comfortable with those?
Yes, quite comfortable. And I think, Madam Chair, that this could be done in probably three meetings.
Okay, very good. Does anyone have any questions about the appointees to the committee? Did you go through a pretty good process to determine who should be on there?
Yes, we worked with the State Department on that, and Dr. Montgresser, and basically it's professionals as well as legislators, so we arrive at the end at a piece of legislation that is entirely workable.
Okay. Senator Wilkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Stevens, I'm on page 2, line 15 through 17. Why wouldn't we help the public members with their travel? And travel expenses, wouldn't that be appropriate for people that are helping us?
Well, I think it through the chair, Senator Walker, I think it certainly would be appropriate. Our thought was that we'd find people who'd be willing to do it at their own expense, and that's asking something of the public, particularly for the villages. We have one village person, but I didn't want to slow this down because of the cost element. It would certainly be a small amount, but just to point out, there is we are asking for a representative from Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. That could be a person from outside of urban Alaska, and also a health consumer from rural Alaska.
Yeah, I think that it applies to line 8 and 9 above, item number 4 and 5. So I don't know, I just sort out for the committee. It just seems like if we have a volunteer that wants to help, we could at least pay for their travel and lodging while they're helping us. I'm not so concerned about per diem, but certainly could help with their travel.
When we usually do those, do we have, I know the state legislators don't count, and anyone from a state agency or department.
Madam Chair, I think it'd be the two people under item number 4 on line 8, consumer of health care resides in rural Alaska. And then actually number 6 could very well be someone from urban Alaska. And I, frankly, my thought was have meetings in Anchorage where everyone is easily available. So there could be two, definitely one person who would be from outside of Alaska who would not be covered under legislative expenses. Or under State Department, the Department of under administration expenses.
Senator Wilkin, do you want to do a conceptual amendment?
Senator Stevens, if you don't mind.
Not at all, through the chair, I'd appreciate that.
And Chair, I would move that the drafters be allowed the latitude to incorporate a conceptual amendment which would provide for travel or other expenses for line number 4 and 5 in line number 4 and 5 on the third resolve. First resolve.
Madam Chair,
however they do that.
Through the chair, it might be number line and 4 and 6. Is that the?
Well, it would be line
8 and 9.
Lines 8 and 9.
Item 4 and 5, line 8 and 9.
Okay. Is there any discussion?
I'm sorry, that 9 is someone from urban Alaska. 6 would be the Native Healthcare Consortium.
My thought would be all the other ones, 1, 2, 3, 6, 7, and 8, would all have their own budgets to travel and be compensated for.
I see.
But the consumer, 4 and 5, would not be, and those are the ones that the amendment addresses.
Thank you.
Is it
that acceptable, Senator Stevens?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay, is there any discussion? You want to move that?
Yes, move a conceptual amendment number 1.
Okay. Is there any objection? Conceptual amendment number 1 is adopted.
Thank you.
Is there further discussion? Anything else to offer, Senator Stevens?
Not from myself, Madam Chair, but I would appreciate if you wouldn't mind briefly if you could hear from Dr. Monsager and Rod BT.
Okay, very good. Rod, did you want to testify or did you just want to present your white paper? Come forward, please.
Chair, I'm Rod Beattie. I'm the president of Alaska State Hospital Nursing Home Association, and I think maybe it'd be good if I just made a few comments. I do have a prepared statement if you'd like me to make that available to the members now.
You would, please. So
First, I'd just like to remind members that our association is made up of all hospitals, nursing homes, assisted living facilities in the state, with the exception of one. They're also all the federal facilities, the tribal facilities, and private, for-profit, and non-profit facilities in the state. So when issues like this come forward, we have a special legislative committee meeting that debates the merits of bills and takes positions on them. And this is one that we looked at. And we do support this legislation and believe that it would be important legislation for you to move forward and feel that it addresses a very timely issue here in Alaska. We agree with the sponsor that there are hospital-acquired infections that can be reduced. We know that our facilities are working hard at that now. This is a process kind of challenge. In my years as the health director in Utah, I can tell you I struggled with it in terms of what was fair to expect of our facilities and We did have reporting of sentinel events that we called them around these kinds of things. A simple example is when someone goes into surgery, what we learned was that when you give an antibiotic, not the particular antibiotic itself, determine the likelihood of having an infection following that surgery. And if it was administered within 1 hour of when the surgery started, that patient had much better chance of not having an infection later. Now that's a challenge in and of itself when you consider the surgical team, all the moving parts to get people into an operating room, including the patient, and who's going to be given the assignment to make sure that that antibiotic is administered within that 1 hour time frame, or that it isn't administered and the surgery is delayed and then you miss the mark. Ultimately, most hospitals have decided that the anesthesiologist is the one who has that responsibility. But there's many of those kinds of issues to work through, and we think that this task force would provide an environment to talk about that, for people to understand what's going on already, and ultimately to arrive at what's a reasonable reporting process. There are a number of reporting processes that we participate in now nationally, and hopefully what we come up here with here in the state would complement that, not be in addition to that, so that it wouldn't be something that would be different than what we're already doing to address this problem. And I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions? Thank you, Rod. Appreciate you being here. Dr. Meinzeiger?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Dr. Monsager. I'm the Director of the Division of Public Health. I, too, want to express my support for this. I've appreciated the chance to work with the sponsor and his staff in development. And to me, this gives us the opportunity here in Alaska to learn several things over the next 6 or 7 months. One is there's about 6 states in the country now that have reporting requirements. And we can learn, there are both good and bad stories to learn from the legislation that's been passed in other states. The Vermont followed this same process last year. They established a resolution as they adjourned in May last year and had an interim group and then had legislation proposed out of this, a study of a group just very much like this in their state last year. And this will give us an opportunity to do that. Just a couple stories about the complexities here in Alaska. One is, when I started here in Alaska 25 years ago, only 30% of surgical care was done as outpatients. Today, close to 75% of surgical care is done as outpatients. The title of this resolution talks about healthcare-associated infections. In my view, if we're going to do this, we want to do it in an inclusive manner that includes freestanding ambulatory surgery, outpatient surgery, et cetera, to capture the universe. That's going to make it harder. Number two, we're going to have data problems from small institutions. In a small institution like the hospital in Kodiak, one infection in a quarter could make a rate that looks bad because the numbers are small. We've got to have a way that we can display data if we decide to do this in a way that is honest for the consumers that they can interpret and doesn't make it look like an institution is doing awful because they had one infection in a quarter. So those are some of the complexities that this will give us an opportunity to work on, and I look forward to this.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for Dr. Meinzeiger? Senator, Dr. Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Have we heard from the private sector as to what kind of strain this is going to be putting on those smaller clinics that are out there, and how is it going to be affecting, how is this affect, see some of the village clinics that are out there that are definitely not inpatient facilities?
As Rod said, we've had some preliminary discussion with ASHNA, and that's why they're a member, and that's also why ANTHC is a member, is to make sure the small institutions are adequately represented in those kinds of questions. It's going to get down to a question of cost and value return from investment to make this a worthwhile exercise. And in my view, if we decide as a state to do this, we need to do it in a way that institutions can afford to do it and that consumers can get adequate information that is valuable to them in making decisions.
If I could continue, Madam Chairman. JCO accreditation is obviously very important, especially the smaller hospitals in all parts of the world, all parts of the nation. Is this going to have an effect on accreditation by those smaller facilities that are trying to maintain JCO accreditation?
Through the chair, my answer is, one is Joint Commission is working on this issue in the same way, and if you go to Joint Commission's website right now, the institutions in Alaska that are accredited, you can find their information, and they only have a couple of surgical indicators right now. They don't really have an infection indicator in their indicator set. The states that have done this so far, that have chosen to do this, this becomes an element in the licensure and certification of institutions that are licensed to do business in the state. That would become the hammer side of it if we as a state decide to do it.
My last question, Madam Chairman, is we look at some of the infections that we're all familiar with, even the layperson, and we're dealing with bacteria and viral infections. How do you plan on covering other infections that are out there that are kind of on the cutting edge, like prions and CJD, and or the resultant CJD, of which we've already had a death in this state from one of those? Are they also covered by this task force?
Through the chair, that's part of the scope is going to be one of the issues for the task force. The states that have started it that seems to have the most useful ramp up have chosen to start with a limited number of infections, to start with ones that have a lot of frequency and are broad applicability across lots of different places. For instance, some variety of urinary tract infection acquired in a hospital or a healthcare environment or something potentially. But you don't start with the whole universe because the data system is so big and the cost would be humongous. You start with a few, build capacity, build learning, and then if the states that have chosen to do this have all established some mechanism by which they can over time add more infections as whatever the decision-making body that's established then decides to do it. So you start small and build.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, sir. Are there any other questions? Dr. Monsager? Thank you very much for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Are there any questions about this? Senator Dyson?
Yeah, just a comment. Dr. Monsager has a goal of a really extensive health education information system for the state. And this is a step in a small, a step in the first portion of that, which is to make information about, in essence, provider performance available in the state. And we'll see stuff here later in our process this year on wanting to do that on immunization, you know, to make those records and stuff available. But Dr. Monsager wants to go on to having a state-based information system that lets folks know about all the diseases and the providers and the performance of providers, and it's a very commendable goal. And Rod is somebody I've worked with quite a bit and has immense credibility with me, and I'm just delighted that he's here in our state using that. Thank you.
Would you like to do a motion to pass this out of committee?
Sure. And Madam Chair, I move that we pass SJR 19 from committee with individual recommendations.
Objection. There being no objection, SJR 19 moves to from committee with individual recommendations and fiscal notes to be determined. Briefities, please. Senate Bill 271 is the next piece of legislation on our agenda, and we've had this in committee before and had a fairly thorough discussion. Are there further questions? Does anyone need a conversation about this bill again? As you recall, this is the legislation that allows a state to take over the NEPA responsibilities through a pilot program that Congressman Young included Alaska in the pilot program, but we need authority to undertake this responsibility and for the state to take over those responsibilities. And it's felt that the lead time and the time spent in doing this would be rapidly increased and not get quite as dragged down on repeated delays. Are there questions from anyone? Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So there's been no changes since the bill was here before?
That's correct.
And the discussion, if I recall before, was there was some concern on the fiscal note of $647,000 a year and the increase in position count. Can't recall offhand the amount of position increases in the current 07 budget that went across the Senate floor today for the department, so maybe we can have a little highlight as far as
Would you repeat your question?
I'm concerned about the position count increase.
Okay.
There's two at the DOT and one at the Attorney General's office, I think, referenced in the fiscal note. And I was wondering if we can just have our memory refreshed by either one of those two departments. Again, we come down to the amount of headcount increase that's going on at the state level. And I'm not convinced as yet that this would improve the process to a degree that would warrant the costs.
John, are you carrying this?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, John McKinnon, Deputy Commissioner of Transportation for Highways and Public Facilities. Through the Chair, Senator Stedman, the fiscal note shows an increase in positions. These are not reflected in the current operating budget, and the increase that you may have seen come across the floor, as I understand it. They are in the fiscal note. These positions are paid for out of the federal-funded program. Or to be more accurate, 90% of these, the position costs are, the 10% would be the state match for these positions. We're looking forward to taking this program on if this bill gets through. And I'd like to say a couple of things that what this does for Alaska is it will streamline the process because it puts these decisions in-house. I mean, these are state decisions, and it brings them into the state for making these decisions and not in the hands of the federal government. The delegation of environmental decision-making authority, it's an important advancement in our relationship with the Federal Highway Administration and the federal aid highway projects. As Alaska's transportation needs grows and the challenges to get them out, the provisions in Safety Lieu provides us an opportunity to employ a very flexible set of tools and address, as well as at the same time addressing the federal environmental needs. This is a small cost in a very large program. And to speed a project up by 1 year, a significant project in the $10 to $12 million range, just the inflationary costs alone of that project will pay for the cost of this program.
Senator Stedman.
And is there any, maybe you can give me a feel for what kind of risk exposure the state has by waiving this sovereign immunity issue? Are we opening a door here where we're going to have more liability exposure than we anticipate or not?
Through the Chair, Senator Stedman, we did contact Federal Highway Administration to get an idea of what their history on litigation has been for NEPA documents. They don't have a lot of history with it because there is not a lot of litigation. What they have typically encountered when there was an action was that they were told by a judge to go back and do something they hadn't done properly. NEPA is a procedural law, and if you hiccup and miss a procedure or a judge rules you didn't do a procedure correctly, they usually require you to go back and redo that procedure. An example of this is there was a case, I believe, in Utah a couple of years ago where when Utah, for a particular project and an environmental impact statement, their public meetings were conducted in an open house format. And an open house format is one where you have a number of display boards up there and the public comes in and talks one-on-one with people involved in the project. And it's a very informal process. It's one that's being used more and more often today. The judge ruled against that because it wasn't done in a traditional public hearing process where people get up one at a time and testify. That was a procedural glitch that they were required to go back and conduct some public hearings over again. The cost of attorney fees that they had to pay, and that was in the order of $20,000 or $30,000. That was the extent of it. Now, that's not to say that there could not be a case that would make it all the way to the Ninth Circuit, for example, in which case the cost could be greater.
I could, Madam Chairman. My understanding for the last 20 years, there hasn't been a whole lot of roads built in Alaska. And hopefully in the next 20, we'll be building some more and expanding our ability for commerce and travel. So is this intended to simplify that process so we don't get tied down in the endless litigation? Or is this just a way of speeding up inevitable litigation 1 year?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, you know, it's our goal and intent to take this seriously and do everything correctly on this, and not only follow the procedure correctly, but you know, have the checks and balances so that we do. I see this as speeding the process up, which that we can get these projects out. There's no guarantee on any project that there won't be litigation. In the history of NEPA in this state, I believe we've had two cases. One is still ongoing. It's the Ileana non-Dalton Road Bridge project, tied up with Pebble Copper and a few other things. And the other one was the Whittier Tunnel. You know, we have prevailed in Ileana non-Dalton, and we meaning Federal Highways and us, and we prevailed on the Whittier Tunnel EIS.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. As you talked about these positions that are there, 90% is going to be paid for with federal money for next year. How long before the federal money is going to pass away and the state has to take on the full responsibility of the fiscal note, as we're seeing has happened with a number of federal programs over this year's budget debates that have gone on?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, this is part of the federal highway federal aid program, Safety Lou. The recent bill is a 5-year bill. This funding is assured for 5 years. This program is a 6-year program. It'll carry through 1 year after. I think it'd be fairly safe to say that if those federal funds for highway construction dried up nationwide, there'd be a serious mutiny across the nation. I think the Highway Trust Fund is supported by motor fuel tax revenue on the federal side, 18 cents a gallon. It's been going on for a long time and pretty certain to continue in one form or another.
So you're saying backfilling is not going to happen for 5 years?
And very likely beyond that.
My last question, Madam Chairman.
Sir.
As we look at this taking over the NEPA process, are there federal funds that we're going to be either more eligible for or less eligible for highways?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I think it's a zero-sum game on that. I don't think it affects more or less eligible.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? I believe we have no one left to testify. Are there any other questions or any information any of the members need on this? Senator Wilton.
Madam Chair, move to report Senate Bill 271 from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
There being no objection, Senate Bill 271 moves from committee with individual recommendation and attached fiscal notes. Senate Bill 10 is before us. Senator Dyson, are you presenting today?
I am, Madam Chair. Thank you for hearing this. The beginning of this bill was a growing awareness in the community that I live near about the tremendous amount of damage from vandalism, and particularly vandalism by young people and of school property. And I worked around this issue for the last 3 years, and I think I even filed a bill on it, but Senator Guess had done some monumental work on it, and I withdrew my bill and joined her on this one. Several of the major philosophical questions having to do with the bill I had input on, but all of the good work that has worked through every issue and problem and question that came up was largely as Senator Guess and staff's work. It's been months since I was involved in presenting this bill, and so you, some of your questions, it may take me a little bit to find out and remember what the answers were. But what this does is continue a process that I have worked on here for the 10 years I've been here, and that is to make sure that we do all we can to get victims recompensed for the damage they've suffered. And we're moving away from the old principle in American law where you pay your fines to the king, and we're getting back to the common law principle of restoring the victim to a pre-offense condition to the degree we can. And this one tries, and you'll when you first look at it, think it's a bit awkward, but it makes the person who does the property damage, or the including the minor, they're the first one up to have to pay back the victim. And if it's a minor, they're on the hook for the first $5,000. Their driver's license can be taken away. Their permanent fund dividend can be taken. They can be put on a payment schedule, that will persevere past their reaching majority at 18 in our state and have to continue to pay until the bills are paid off. And parents, if the child has a parent, the parents are on the hook for the money over the $5,000, and it has established that the parents get to pay an extra $15 in of the damages. And then the money's after $20,000, then the child will be continuing to make payments on or liquidate assets to get it taken care of. It allows for the driver's license to be either suspended or conditionally suspended until the liability is satisfied. One of the philosophical discussions that you will probably hear today is, what do you do with a uncontrollable child? And if a parent has a child that's run away, and the parent notifies the authorities that the child's a runaway, and then out of control of the parent, parent's off the hook. Child is still on the hook to make the restitution. And another contentious issue is, what do we do with children in state custody who are placed in foster homes? And I believe it'd be very difficult to attract foster parents if they believe that they were going to be liable for any damage that this child did while he was in the foster parent's custody. So the bill provides that if the child does damage, the child's in the custody of the state, that the child still has liability, but the foster parent does not. And the state picks up the additional liability. And if you accept my presupposition is that the victim deserves to be restored, somebody's got to have the responsibility. So this bill establishes the child does, and the child will be working at paying it off until it's paid off. If it's a child in state custody, the state will pick up the additional responsibilities for that. It allows the courts and it'll largely be a criminal court because these are criminal actions, to set up the payment schedule that takes into account the perpetrator's ability to pay and or their parents, and sets up that confiscation of the child and or the parents' permanent fund dividends and other assets to satisfy the liability. So I've just told you more than I remember, and I will be delighted to try and answer any questions. And I think do we have some public testimony, Madam Chair? I think we do. Ellis, glad to hear from them.
Are there questions to ask the sponsor? Okay, there might be, there's some folks online, and and one person in this room. Let's see. First, we'll go to OffNet's Kathy Hansen. Kathy Hansen?
Yes, this is Kathy Hansen.
Could you introduce yourself and tell who you represent and begin your testimony, please?
Yes, thank you. My name is Kathy Hansen. I'm an attorney at the Alaska Office of Victims' Rights, an agency of the legislature, and I'm here to provide testimony by telephone on behalf of the Office of Victims' Rights.
Right ahead.
Thank you. This proposed bill, in its current form, has many positive changes for crime victims and their ability to obtain restitution in juvenile matters. The Office of Victims' Rights supports the concept of consistency when it involves laws that affect the ability of a crime victim to obtain restitution. The amount and ability of a crime victim to collect should not depend on whether a juvenile is placed on informal probation, whether they're formally adjudicated a delinquent, and whether or not the delinquent or his parents are sued when the state does not prosecute. Victims, an important part of the criminal process for victims or the juvenile process for victims is restitution. Victims often pay a high emotional price and should not additionally be required to bear the economic cost of juvenile delinquent acts. It's important to remember that victims will bear the financial loss out of pocket and up front and will have to wait often months or years for payment. The wait and the delay will have two stages. First, the victim must wait until a juvenile case is resolved, either formally or informally, and restitution is ordered. Second, the collection effort. It can take months or even years to collect if there will ever be any collection made, and that's just a reality of victim restitution in general. In 1994, citizens overwhelmingly recognized the importance of restitution when they voted in favor of adopting a provision in the Constitution, the state Constitution, Article 1, Section 24, that included a constitutional right to restitution. So this is currently a constitutional right that all crime victims have. The Office of Victims' Rights supports full restitution for victims and prompt payment when possible, and cannot support any legislative change that would not promote that goal. For that reason, the Office of Victims' Rights has concerns and would have to oppose any language in the bill that would limit a juvenile's responsibility to a $5,000 cap. The victims should be paid first. And if the parents are having to pay on behalf of the juvenile, they can simply collect from the juvenile as the child's parent by taking their PFDs as they come in annually or by other means, by facilitating the minor working. The Office of Victims' Rights opposes any cap on parental liability because it would it could potentially affect the victim's right and ability to obtain full restitution. Full restitution is essential to make the crime victim whole. And parents should not have limitations on their liability, especially if they're financially able to pay more than $15,000. The that was most recently filed, number 4, addresses the confusion or the potential complications of law collecting on restitution between parents and juveniles. And I would just note that that same problem would exist or complication would exist for any crime victim who chose to collect privately. I'd like to point out to the committee that the purpose of the juvenile delinquency statutes address both juvenile and parental accountability. And by holding the parents fully liable, it will promote the goal by keeping the parents involved, and they have an interest in ensuring that the juvenile will work and take the steps necessary to pay back the restitution to them. A portion of 4712010. These are the current legislative goals and purposes of the juvenile delinquency statute. I'm going to read sections B1, B, 3, 6, 7, 8, and 12. And they say that the purpose of this chapter, the juvenile delinquency chapter, is to respond to a juvenile offender's needs in a manner that is consistent with the need to hold each juvenile offender directly accountable for the offender's conduct, the need to require parental or guardian participation in the juvenile justice process, the need to create an expectation that parents will be held responsible for the conduct and needs of their children, the need to ensure that victims, witnesses, parents, foster parents, guardians, and juvenile offenders, and all other interested parties are treated with dignity, respect, and courtesy and sensitivity throughout all legal proceedings, and to ensure that victims and witnesses of crimes committed by juveniles are afforded the same rights as victims and witnesses of crime committed by adults. And currently, there isn't a similar cap on or limitation of liability on adult criminal offenders. And that's my testimony.
Kathy, does that complete your testimony?
Yes, ma'am.
Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you, Kathy, for your testimony and your help for victims. Did you bring these concerns up when this bill was before the Senate Judiciary Committee?
Sir, yes, we did. I'm actually repeating and reiterating the notes that from the testimony that was provided for the Judicial Committee.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other questions for Kathy? Kathy, thank you for joining us today. Appreciate it. And there's Stacy Steinberg in Anchorage. You would introduce yourself and give you the name of the organization you represent, please.
Thank you, through the chair. My name is Stacy Steinberg. I'm an assistant attorney general with the Attorney General's Office, and I'm also the supervisor and statewide section chief for our collections and support section. One of the things that our section does is we do collect restitution for victims in juvenile delinquency cases that have gone through the formal adjudication process and the court has issued a restitution judgment. I'm here today to testify and answer any questions about the impact of this current legislation would have on our ability to collect restitution for victims and how this legislation would affect our current daily operations. My primary focus is on Section 13 of the bill, and Section 13 deals with restitution in the context of formal adjudications for a juvenile. As I explained in my introduction, we only get involved once it's gone through formal adjudication and the court has actually entered a restitution order. I am somewhat familiar that there is an informal process and we are not involved at all in the informal process. What the current bill proposes to do in Section 13 is to change the current system for awarding restitution. What will happen is that under the new section, it will take us much longer to collect the money for the victim, and it will require more resources at our office to collect the same amount of money. The significant change in Section 13 is that, first off, it eliminates joint and several liability between the juvenile and his or her parents. And then it also sets up a structure where the juvenile is responsible for the first $5,000 worth of damages. After that $5,000, the parent, if there is a parent, would be responsible for the next $15,000. And then above that amount, the child would then again be responsible. And what I'd like to do is to give the committee just an example to show how this would work in the practical world. Right now, we have joint and several liability, which means if a judge orders a juvenile to pay $5,000 in damages and says, you know, his or her parents are also jointly responsible, that means our section can collect the entire $5,000 from any of those three people. We could collect the entire amount from the juvenile if the juvenile has the money. We could collect the entire amount from one parent if one parent has financial resources, or the other parent, or any combination of those three. It basically says they're all on the hook for the $5,000, and however we can collect it, we collect the total $5,000 from the victim. Under this current system, if it's a $5,000 judgment, which about two-thirds of our cases are at $5,000 or less, we could only get it from the child. Normally, a juvenile doesn't have a lot of financial resources, just as a generalization. Our primary tool for collecting restitution is through the permanent fund garnishment. We do a garnishment every fall on any case that we have that's eligible. We do a garnishment on a PFD. Under the current system, if it's joint and several with the juvenile and all two parents, we can collect this judgment in generally 2 years. If the permanent fund was $1,000 each, the first year we can collect three PFDs and send that on to the victim, and then the second year we can collect the remaining $2,000. If only the child is responsible for the first $5,000, it would probably take us 5 years to collect the same amount of money and then pass that money on to the victim. And again, we have about 350 juvenile files, and out of those files, about two-thirds or 230 are less than 5,000. We have about a third that are over 5,000. And joint and several liability is significant because out of that 350 cases, probably about 90% or about 330 of those cases are all joint and several with the child and at least one parent. If we have a case where it's over 5,000, it would require additional resources from our office also, because we would then have to open up potentially three files instead of opening one file for $10,000. Now we have to open one file for the juvenile, and then another file for the one parent, and then another file for the other parent. And just the process of having to open more files, taking longer to do PFD garnishments, taking longer to collect this money, would result in additional resources required by office to basically collect the same amount of money. We have submitted a fiscal note that was submitted, and on that fiscal note we estimated we'd probably need another paralegal or litigation assistance. For the first year we allocated $116,000 basically do the same work that we're doing now, and then after the first year it would drop slightly because of equipment costs to $110,000 a year. The other aspect of the bill is it does require the court to set up a payment plan. From the collections perspective, that is a little bit problematic depending on how the payment plan is set up. If there is a valid payment plan, if the person is not in default of the payment plan, we can't collect any extra money if they get any inheritance, windfall. In fact, we can't even collect the PFD unless the order would specifically say, in addition to the payment plan, you can collect the PFD. Just the physical process of having to go and review each file to ensure, can we garnish on the PFD, can we get additional collection. You know, once there's a payment plan set up by the court, we can't change that, and we have to go through some additional procedures like notifying a person that they're in default before we can take any additional steps. That's just a quick overview and a perspective of how this bill would impact collections for victims. Certainly, I'm available if the committee has any questions or has more or wants more detail about how we do our collections, or if there's any questions about the fiscal note.
Other questions? Senator Dyson.
Yeah. Thank you, Stacy, for helping us on this. I appreciate your comments about the joint and several. The issue is many of these children only have a single parent in residence who's often working and struggling to be a single parent. As I understand, under existing law, you'd be able to go and collect from the non-custodial parent who has perhaps not even been involved in the child's life and collect from them. Is that correct?
Through the chair. Senator Dyson, we can only collect from a parent that's listed on the judgment. When we get the case in, all we get is essentially the judgment. We may or may not even know what happened in the underlying case because it's not directly relevant to our effort to collect the money. When we get the judgment from the court or through juvenile justice, it says right on the face of the judgment that the minor is responsible. It lists the amount, and then the judgment will indicate if one of the parents will be responsible. And sometimes there's two parents, sometimes there's one parent. So at our stage, we don't know why only one parent would be listed. That's at the court level where the court determines what parent would be jointly and severally responsible. And I can't address what factors the court considers under current law because, again, as I explained, we only get involved once there is a judgment. We just collect the money.
Yeah, okay, that clarifies it. I thought you were speaking to the public policy issue of whether or not it was good public policy to go after the responsible parent as and child, but really you're just speaking to the difficulty of you all as bill collectors. Is that correct?
Through the chair. Yes, Senator Dyson. We're just explaining just for the practical results of how this current legislation would affect our ability to essentially do our job, which is to collect the money for the victim. And we don't get involved at all about determinations about which parent should be responsible or not responsible.
Yeah, I think you just said yes, and I appreciate that. And the issue about requiring the child perpetrator to pay the first $5,000, and that might slow down the rate of recompensing the victim. Would you suggest a different figure?
Through the chair, I hadn't thought about that. Certainly, I think I've explained kind of just the practical results of most of the time juveniles don't have a lot of financial resources. I mean, by definition, they're under 18. They may have a part-time job, or maybe they don't. Hopefully, they're going to school. Our primary collection tool is the permanent fund dividend, especially for the juvenile, if the juvenile is still under the age of 18. So I don't have a suggestion, because even if you say the first $1,000, well, hopefully if the PFD is the first $1,000, hopefully we could collect that within the first year. I guess the practical reality is that the lower you have it for the juvenile, or for our situation, the best case scenario is the joint and several situation, because that allows us to collect from whomever have the funds, or all of them together. So I don't have a great suggestion, only that most likely if it was a lower amount, since juveniles typically don't have any assets, usually parents are a little bit better resource.
Yeah, so I appreciate that, and I want to emphasize you're talking about the practical stuff. But we are required by state law and inclined by the Constitution to also have in mind the reformation of the juvenile to being a useful citizen and abandoning their irresponsible behavior. That's why them having to pay a penalty that they recognize is very useful. Am I assumed by your comments that you never go and take away the teenager's car or television set or iPod or any of those kind of assets when you're trying to restore a victim?
Through the chair, our office doesn't have the resources to do that type of collection from a practical reality. Typically, they don't have large resources, and certainly if we were to go and be able to get a court order to grab their iPod, the issue then becomes, can we sell the iPod, and how much money can we get from the iPod so that we can then give the money to the victim?
All right. Thank you. That's all the questions I have.
Thank you, Senator Tyson. Thank you very much, Stacy. Oh, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Ms. Steinberg, can you tell me what happens when a juvenile realizes that he's not going to get his permanent fund anyway, and so why apply for it? What recourse does a victim have in that particular case?
Through the chair. Most of our cases, the juvenile is applying for their PFD. I'll have to go back to double check some of our figures. It certainly is a good idea if the court would order the juvenile to apply for the PFD. Certainly, there is no harm in that, and it reminds the juvenile this is a responsibility that you do have, and that you need to do that. You know, in some cases, not necessarily in the restitution cases, but in the collection process in general, occasionally you do have that type of attitude where someone knows that they're not going to get their permanent fund dividend, they won't apply for it. Typically, in many of our cases, especially if they're under $5,000, hopefully we're collecting it within 1 to 2 years. And of course, the first year, they may not know when they apply that it'll be garnished later in the year. There doesn't seem to be any harm in having the court order the person to apply for their permanent fund dividend. Certainly, it's something that's simple to do, and I think that provision of the bill would certainly be very helpful. And if the committee needed, I could try to get numbers from our collection unit to see it. How many cases do we have a juvenile that owes restitution? We try to do the permanent fund garnishment, and we find that there's no match, i.e., they didn't apply for it.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Senator Tyson?
Yeah, and Senator Olson, Section 7 provides for that. It's on page 4. The court may order them to apply for a dividend so they can be seized.
Section 7?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Senator Dyson, for that information. Thank you, Stacy, for hanging on there. We do have another bill coming up in about 10, 15 minutes. So I'm going to ask the remaining four speakers to be pretty concise and give us your concerns or praise, and let us know how this bill is looking. Gail Voigtlander?
Yes, Madam Chairman. For the record, my name is Gail Voigtlander. I'm an Assistant Attorney General. I'm the Supervising Attorney for the Torts and Workers' Compensation Section. My comments will be regarding principally Sections 5 and 6 of the current version of the bill. I'm actually covering for Annie Carpinetti, who is more familiar with the juvenile delinquency side of things, but she was unavailable. Principally, my comments go to the revisions in AS 34.50.020. And I'm not testifying to advocate or not advocate the bill, but simply to point out that it does suggest some policy calls that this body needs to think about because they are raised by at least these sections of the bill. The first point I was going to make is a concern that the Attorney General's office has heard from victim rights groups, and I think that's been addressed by previous testimony, that the concern is that restitution, full restitution, will be slowed down because of the staggered nature of from whom you can recover what portion of the damages. So I won't add to that, as I think it's been fully covered. The second policy issue for this body to consider is that this does create a sort of strict liability for parents. There is Alaska case law, two cases, Dinsmore Puff and Sandsmith v. State, that as to parental responsibilities addresses the issue that parents, if they have noticed that there's an issue with their child and they need to take certain actions, must be responsible in doing that. But in terms of making parents the guarantor of children's actions, that raises policy problems, especially as children are older. It becomes more and more difficult to control their behaviors. And so I simply point out that there's a policy call to be made there. A third policy issue is this change that this bill prompts. Under the existing law, the state foster parents, receiving homes, detention homes, children's institutions, and runaway shelters are not liable for property damages that may have been caused by someone in their care. The state has a very large number of children at any given time in their legal custody. Within their legal custody, the children may have been returned to their parents, but still be in state legal custody. The children might be placed with other relatives. The children may be in state licensed foster homes. The children may be in restrictive settings, such as under the Division of Juvenile Justice. And truly, the only children who are in state custody, state legal custody, for whom state employees are directly responsible, would be those who are within state institutions, and that's a very small number of the total. So the policy call is whether to have the state pick up that portion of the restitution when the state is already having to have custody of these children because of situations of neglect and abuse by parents, and for which the state is already paying for support services and rehabilitation services, or children that are within the Division of Juvenile Justice, which of course has to try to achieve at least restrictive settings for the children. So again, the policy call is whether this body wants to have the state, who really doesn't have their hands on these children other than through the variety of placements that are available, to be responsible. Another brief policy issue that this body should consider is, since it's open-ended in terms of the restitution that a child ultimately could be liable for if you have a very large amount of damage, and after the $20,000 the parents are out of the loop, and then it's open-ended as to the child, a large number of the children who are doing this kind of damage may be ones who are struggling to become responsible citizens, and a policy issue is whether you want to have them going into their majority with a very large debt to satisfy. It may serve a disincentive for them to actually want to achieve good employment, things of that nature. But again, that's a policy call to tug between the victims' rights and the rehabilitation of children who are committing delinquent acts. And finally, it's not a policy issue, but a couple drafting issues that are in the bill. In the existing statute, AS 3450020, it's very clear that the state foster parents receiving homes, detention homes, runaway shelters are not liable. And that has the group that we hear the most often from are the foster parents, and that helps them feel comfortable in assuming the duties that they do as foster parents. It is because that section has been drastically changed, and there is no longer the language in this draft which says that foster parents, detention homes, those groups are not liable. There is a concern we're hearing that that lack of clarity is of concern to foster parents, and that's simply a drafting issue. There's one other drafting issue, which is that, this drafting issue is the bill uses the language for the exception of when the state is not liable, but the parents are, even when the children are in state legal custody. It uses the term physical custody of the parent, and really, if the state has legal custody, then the correct term would be physical care of the parent. Again, that's just a drafting issue. One last policy issue is that under existing regulations, foster parents, under certain circumstances, can request from the Department of Health and Social Services restitution to them when their children, foster children, create property damage up to $5,000. The issue that's raised from this is, insofar as this is a statute, does this then mean that foster parents no longer turn to Department of Health and Social Services for that property damage up to $5,000, and now have to go into the queue to try to collect from the child? With those identification of policy issues for this body to consider, I simply wanted to add, finally, the Department of Law is certainly willing to continue to discuss these issues and work with members of the committee or staff as the chair directs. Thank you for this opportunity to at least flag some of these issues.
Okay, thank you very much. And also, we are running very, very short on time. Larry and Olga Krejci in Kenai? Excuse me if I messed up your name.
It's Krejci.
Krejci, thank you very much. Go right ahead.
I'm here to speak on behalf of our of parents, I guess, of our situation, and I'll try to keep it brief. Thank you, Senator Dyson, for your explanation of the bill. I am a father of 10 children. I presently have 4 children at home. 6 are gone out of the house. I've been a pastor in Hawaii and have lived in Alaska now for 11 years, 8 of them in Fairbanks and 3 of them here in Soldotna. We came to Soldotna to take care of my mother-in-law with an Alzheimer's situation. 2 years ago, my daughter, Deborah, who all of our children were homeschooled and had good grades with IDEA. And 2 years ago, my daughter, Deborah, without our consent and knowledge, snuck out of the house at midnight and was involved in a date rape. After this situation, she became the antithesis of what she was. Formerly, before this, she was pretty much a good girl, wanted to, help her mother with cooking. I mean, and I don't know how she got this idea in her head, but she thought she was met this guy at work and thought that she'd like to date him, and we have certain policies on dates that they should be group dates. While she stuck out of the house was date rape, and it really affected her personality. Our family is just recovering today. She became a runaway. She ran away. She said this is not her home anymore, and she ran away from her house and ran to Anchorage for the exciting life of Anchorage. We tried to get her help. We tried to get her counseling. She said she didn't need counseling. We revoked her driver's license. The police could bring her back to our house, but the way the laws are written now, the teeth of parents are pulled. And While they could bring her back, they couldn't force her to stay, nor could we. She overdosed on sleeping pills. They called us, Providence Hospital called us to consent, to give consent for treatment because she's under 18. Yet at 16, we had no control over what she could or couldn't do. As a policeman told me, she could have sex with anything on legs, and we can't say anything about it. After her third runaway attempt, she was in Anchorage, and we revoked her license. She kept telling her sister online that she was going to drive a car. And our concern here is making parents liable for the actions of runaway teens. We tried to get her therapy. She refused it. We tried everything, Children and Family Services. It didn't do any good. She did what she wanted to do, and we had no control. To make parents liable for something like this, in my view, is the problem. The children who commit these acts should be liable for themselves. We are still, she wrecked our car. We're still, we still haven't collected for that because she's left the state. My solution to your issue of how to collect is just to give the same message you give to deadbeat dads. Give them to rebellious children, too. Just as you follow them through with the court system, through their tax record, through their Social Security number, through what they make, follow these children and make them accountable for the damages they do. The scriptures talk about restoration, and I think we're on the right track here. But we need to pursue it and not blame the parents who, while there are many neglectful parents, there are many parents out there and single moms who are very responsible with their children, and yet the children rebel and they have no control despite everything they do. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Now, Olga, does that conclude your testimony as well?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And in this room, Tony Newman.
Thank you. My name is Tony Newman. I'm Program Officer with the Division of Juvenile Justice.
Thank you.
I thank you for the opportunity to be here to appear to testify on Senate Bill 10. The Division appreciates efforts to assist its mission of holding juvenile offenders accountable for behaviors that cost Alaskans emotional and financial difficulty. And we've also appreciated the willingness and openness of the co-sponsors to consult and work with us as they've crafted this bill to try and enhance juvenile accountability. The mission of the Division of Juvenile Justice, as described in Title 47, is to promote a balanced juvenile justice system that imposes accountability of juvenile offenders and equips them with the skills needed to live responsibly and productively, and also afford protection and redress to victims. And it is this third piece, promoting the safety and restoration of victims and communities, that we are concerned is jeopardized by this bill. The restitution payment structure set up with the youth only responsible for the first $5,000 in damages, the parent for the next $15,000, and the youth only responsible for any remainder, will likely slow down the speed with which victims are repaid for damages and will not encourage youth and their parents to work together to address the damages caused by delinquent acts. Whether a juvenile case is managed informally or formally, the provisions of the bill related to juvenile restitution remove the current joint and several liability system that encourages parents and youths to work together to see that restitutions to victims are repaid promptly and in full. And while this may conceivably have the effect of holding juveniles more directly and individually accountable to their victims, in the end, we're concerned it will result in victims having to wait for the youth to gather either through permanent fund dividends payments or through work for the money due to them. If you imagine a youth who's committed $3,000 in damages under current statute, juvenile justice staff or the courts are able to order and collect that restitution directly from parents and the youth at once. Even if the youth and parent have no other source of cash income, they'd be able to repay most, if not all, of that restitution within a year by together using their permanent fund dividends. If you remove the requirement that parents participate, the victim would now have to wait 3 years for the youth to make annual payments of approximately $1,000 each. So while we support efforts to hold youth accountable, we're concerned about doing this at a cost to victims. Title 47, the statute describing the goals and purpose of the state's juvenile justice system, states that one of Alaska's goals is to ensure that the victims of crimes committed by juveniles are afforded the same rights as victims of crimes committed by adults. This bill contradicts that statute by providing a restitution repayment scheme that will take longer for victims of juvenile crimes to be repaid than victims of crimes by adults, and as such gives us concern. An additional concern with the bill is that related to driver's license revocations. The bill states that a juvenile formally adjudicated for any delinquent offense shall have their driver's license revoked. Currently, driver's licenses shall be revoked only for minor consuming violations and misconduct involving controlled substance and firearm violations. The division is unaware of any evidence linking effectiveness of driver's license revocations with reducing offenses that have nothing to do with driving. The division has spent the last few years focusing and investing in research-based approaches to work with delinquent youth, and legislation that imposes measures without regard to whether the proposal has been linked to reductions in offenses is inconsistent with the mission of the division, the division's data-driven approach. I want to reemphasize that the division takes its mission of holding juvenile offenders accountable seriously. We have worked to see that juvenile offenders managed through informal processes have repaid over 90% of the restitution payments owed to victims over the past several fiscal years. And we've worked closely with the Department of Law Collections Unit to ensure that restitutions ordered through the formal court system are repaid promptly and in full. The division is eager to work with the legislature to explore ways that further increase accountability of juvenile offenders in ways that are compatible with our obligation toward victims. Thank you again. This concludes my testimony.
Thank you very much, Tony, for coming in. We appreciate it. Senator Dyson.
Did you really mean to infer that there's no evidence that taking a kid's driver's license motivates them?
No, I'm saying that under the bill, it's through the chair, any misdemeanor or felony would be occasion for revocation of a driver's license. I know that there is evidence that certain offenses are linked to decreases if you take away a driver's license.
You said that there's no evidence that taking away a driver's license would motivate the kid or had any link to change in their the implication was to repaying their debt. And you said you were against any form of punishment, I don't know what the word is, where there was no demonstrable link to being helpful. Did I mishear you?
Through the chair, I'll reread what I said. I wrote that the division is unaware of evidence linking effectiveness of driver's license revocations with reducing offenses that have nothing to do with driving, and that we have spent...
Yeah, that's it.
Okay. And so there are offenses that, in fact, I know have been linked to reductions in recidivism, as we've got some offenses on the statutes right now, misconduct involving a controlled substance.
I heard you.
Okay.
That's amazing. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Tony, for joining us today. Please. Senator Dyson, it sounds like there's still work to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I would enjoy committee members letting me know that any questions or concerns they have.
Okay. Thank you very much. Well, we'll set that aside and look for another day. And we'll take a 5-minute break while we get ready to go to Senate Bill 305.